on my patch," said Hamish. "Once they start, they often go on." He walked out of the police station with them when they left. How simple love was, if you were lucky enough to find the right woman, thought Hamish, watching the glow on Charlie's face as he helped tall Annie into his car as if she were a fragile piece of china. He then visited the vet where Sonzi lay, with tubes sprouting out of her body. Her eyes were closed. "She's still in a coma," said Peter Abraham. "You have to face up to it, Hamish. If she doesn't come out of it soon, it would be better just to pull the plug." "A bit longer," said Hamish. "I'm trying for the Hill Run prize, so I'll be able to pay you." "Aye, the news is round the village, and they're all going to be there to cheer you on. Good luck." Elspeth Grant arrived on Saturday to find the police station closed and the village largely deserted. Only Archer MacLean was there at the harbour to take a boatload of tourists round the loch, as he augmented his fishing with tourism during the summer. He told Elspeth that Hamish had gone to try for the Hill Run prize, so he would be able to pay the vet for Sonsy's care. Elspeth often thought Hamish's devotion to the cat bordered on the unhealthy, but curiously she asked the vet if she could see Sonsy. "He'll need to make up his mind soon to end it," said Peter. "Funny thing," said Elspeth. "You would sometimes think Hamish was married to that cat. Is Hamish sure it is Sonsy?"
"Sure as anything.
Oh, there's the door. Let yourself out." Elspeth turned for a last look at the large wild cat, and as she looked, one slit of eye opened and shone with yellow malice. "Peter!" shouted Elspeth. "The cat's awake!" The vet came running in. He bent over Sonsy and examined her.
"No, it must have been a trick of the light," he said, straightening up. "No change at all."
But Elspeth felt a superstitious frisson as she got in her car and headed for Strathbiggy. Most of the village had turned out, even the Curry sisters. The prize was £1,000 and attracted runners from all over Britain. It was more like mountain running, being in part up the steep flanks of Ben Corm to near the summit. Most of the runners were defeated by this, being used to flat marathons. Hamish felt uneasy and wished he had trained for the run. Usually he made sure he was in peak condition. The weather could not have been better, sunshine and not a breath of wind. The heather was turning purple. The air was full of smells of candy floss, hot dogs and car exhaust, and loud with noise from the usual fairground set up by the gypsies. The gun was fired and they set off. Hamish realized dismally that he was not going to win. And then, standing up on a rise, he saw Elspeth holding a placard which said, "Cat woke up." Suddenly it seemed as if his legs had become like steel springs. He raced up the mountain as if jet-propelled, followed by the hysterical cheers of the Loch Doo villagers. Then their noise faded, and he seemed alone as he flew up over the mountain, plunging down the other side. Then back came the roar of the crowd and the finishing tape bright in front of him as he crashed through it and fell on the ground, his heart pumping. Elspeth heard someone say, "He ran like a man possessed," and again felt that odd, superstitious shudder. And who was that girl, trying to wind herself around Hamish as he was led up to the judge's table?
"Get off, Alison," Hamish was saying.
"All that money," cooed Alison Ford, putting on her best seductive pout. "You come along tonight, and I'll tell you something to solve yon murder."
"And I'll book you right now for withholding evidence," said Hamish.
"I'll deny the lot. Come along at 8 o'clock, and bring the champagne."
"Mr. Macbeth," barked one of the judges, "we're waiting."
Hamish accepted the prize money, held up the trophy, and then looked around for Alison Ford, but the nurse had disappeared. Probably just lying again, he thought. But she had seen Paul on the night he had disappeared.
Elspeth appeared at his elbow.
"Well done, Hamish." Hamish suddenly sank down onto the ground and put his head between his knees.
"I feel a bit faint," he mumbled.
"Be all right in a minute.
What's this about Sonsy?"
"When I was there, she opened one eye. The vet said I must have imagined it, but I'm sure I didn't. Let's get you back to the station, and you can have a rest." When Elspeth had made sure Hamish was tucked up in bed, with Lugs beside him,
she returned to the Tomal Castle Hotel in time to meet Charlie and Annie. She congratulated them on their engagement and admired Annie's ring of gold and garnets. She said she was surprised they hadn't gone to give Hamish a cheer. "We got there too late," said Annie. "Headquarters is giving an engagement party for us tomorrow at 3 in the afternoon. Will you be able to come?" Elspeth felt that old superstitious fear. She felt she should hurry back to Glasgow and forget about Hamish and wildcats that did not look like Sonsy. But she nodded. "I'll drop in. Then I'd better get off to Glasgow." Although not specifically invited, the villagers of Loch Doo hired a bus to take the old ones to the engagement party, the others following by car. Mild sunshine tamed the usually savage countryside, and the flanks of the tall mountains were purple with heather. Some of the villagers were clutching presents out of the Hamish Macbeth cupboard, having taken back presents when Hamish's engagements had failed. None of them believed in what they thought was a mercenary idea of giving a store list, and so it looked as if Charlie and Annie would have at least 5 crystal jam dishes and 4 toasters. The first person Hamish saw was Detective Chief Inspector Blair. He had thinned down, and his normally groggy face was pale and his eyes clear. Really off the booze for once, thought Hamish. Trays of whiskey were being carried around, then the door opened and Charlie and Annie walked in. They were in civilian clothes. Annie had her fair hair tied in a loose knot on top of her head. Her large grey eyes looked luminous. She was wearing a low-cut white cotton blouse over a short blue linen skirt and high heels. A modern goddess, thought Hamish. And then he saw the way Blair was staring at her and experienced a shiver of fear. No policeman of any intelligence can serve any time in the Highlands of Scotland without knowing a good deal about drunks. Drunks, thought Hamish bitterly, did not fall in love. They fell into obsession. The look on Blair's face was a mixture of adoration, longing, and hunger. That was until his eyes turned on Charlie and burned with savage jealousy and hate. He found Elspeth at his elbow. "Bad vibes, Hamish," she whispered. "I think it's the cat." "Havers," said Hamish. "It's Blair. He wanted to kill Charlie before. Now he'll really try. But the pair are off to Uist, the morn's morn." Elspeth was wondering whether to offer to stay the night when Priscilla walked in, and Elspeth wondered how on earth Hamish could still light up at the very sight of her. Priscilla's present was a fine ram, which she said was waiting at the hotel for Charlie. The colonel had said he would drive it to Uist in the horse trailer. "Oh, well," thought Elspeth, "I'd be better off back in Glasgow anyway." But something made her say to Priscilla, "Have you taken a good look at that wildcat?" "I popped into the vet's. Looks like Sonsy. Why?" "I think there's something not right about it. I think it's someone who's come back." "You don't believe that stuff, do you?" asked Priscilla. "I know some of the villagers think that the seals were people at one time." Elspeth shrugged. "Just a bad feeling." Hamish would have liked to stick closely to Charlie and Annie until he saw them off on the road to Uist the next day, but he knew he had better see Alison at 8 in the evening and hope it wasn't another fantasy. He dropped in to see the wildcat, but it was still unconscious. He could not keep paying to keep it alive forever. Sooner or later, he must make up his mind to let it die. As he walked along the waterfront, it was such a beautiful evening that he was reluctant to spoil it. The sea loch was like violet glass edged with pink in the setting sun. Little feathery clouds stretched across the sky. The forestry trees deepened to dark green, and the heather on the flanks of the mountains became a softer purple. The villagers didn't have dinner in the evening. They had high tea consisting of one dish, scones, and cakes. The air still smelled of sugar and strong tea. Television sets flickered in parlours. He approached Mrs. Mackenzie's boarding house, angry at Alison because he was sure she had nothing really interesting to tell him. He rang the doorbell and waited. There was no reply. He was surprised because he knew Mrs. Mackenzie was nearly always home at this time of the evening. Callers were placed in a grim living room on the ground floor to wait. He tried the handle and found the door unlocked. He walked in. The living room,
or waiting room, as he often thought of it, was empty. He could hear the faint sounds of a television set coming from a room off the hall. Mrs. Mackenzie's sanctum, as she liked to call it. He recognized the back of Mrs. Mackenzie's head as she was sitting in a low-backed armchair. Midsummer Murders was showing. "Mrs. Mackenzie," called Hamish. No response. He went round and stood in front of her. Her eyes were closed and her breathing heavy. He felt her neck. There was a strong pulse. On a bamboo table beside her chair was a half-full glass of wine. He sniffed it cautiously. He tried to wake her without success. He phoned for an ambulance and then slowly mounted the stairs. A man in one of the rooms volunteered that Alison had the room at the end, next to the fire escape. Hamish went along. No answer to his knock, and her door was locked. He ran back to the kitchen, where he knew the spare keys were up on a board, and found the one to Alison's room. He ran back up and unlocked the door. Empty, strong smell of cheap scent. He went out and examined the fire escape, and wished he had done so earlier, because it was opened just a little, enough to let someone get back in. He would need to wait for the ambulance and put in a police report as well. He phoned Jimmy, who said the old girl was probably drunk, but to let him know if it looked serious. The ambulance men arrived. Hamish bagged up the bottle for evidence, and having seen Mrs. Mackenzie borne off, went back up to the fire escape and studied the steps down. At the bottom there was still a damp patch of earth, and he saw the imprint of high heels in it. There was another patch by a gate in the hedge. Something had made Alison decide not to meet him. A damp gust of wind blew against his cheek. He noticed choppy waves on the loch and black streamers of cloud like long grasping arms stretching in from the Atlantic. Peter the vet thought he heard a movement from the surgery and went in before packing up for the night, but the cat still lay in its network of tubes. Hamish decided to have one look at the peat bog before calling for a search party. Alison had wanted to tell him something, and now she was missing. He began to run, although his legs were still aching from the day's event. There lay the bog, the livid green moss surrounding it, shining like emeralds in the encroaching gloom. And at the far edge, a weak movement. He took out his phone and called for the fire brigade and for backup. Then he lay on his stomach, down beside the top of a head, and sank his long arms down into the sludge of the bog. But he could not move her. The fire brigade had fortunately been called out on a false alarm in Loch Doo, and so they arrived after only a few minutes, taking over just as the rain began to come down in sheets. This had the effect of loosening the body, and they were able to drag it out. Alison's chalk-white face stared up at the tumbling clouds above, and rain washed the mud from her face. "She's got a wee bit of a pulse," shouted a fireman. "Give us the oxygen quick, Jimmy." Hamish prayed all the way to the hospital. Chapter 6. And come he slow or come he fast, it is but death who comes at last. Sir Walter Scott. By the time Hamish got back to the police station, he was shivering with cold, soaked to the skin. The initial report on Alison's condition was not good. Her nose and mouth had been blocked by the bog, and brain damage was feared. They had found her mobile phone in her pocket, but it looked ruined, and the forensic department sent it to a specialist in Glasgow in the hope of getting some information out of it. Mrs. Mackenzie was good news. She had woken in the hospital, furious. She had been taking sleeping pills because she had not been sleeping well. He had a hot shower and scrubbed himself down with a rough towel. Then he made himself a cup of strong tea and settled himself on his battered sofa in his pyjamas and dressing gown, flicking through the channels in the hope of finding something on television that would take his mind off the murder. An advertisement crooned, "Why not leave your worries behind? Relax on one of our famous cruise ships." Hamish sat up straight. Why had Granny Dinwiddie, a self-centred old biddy if there ever was one, decided to throw herself overboard? And anyway, the steep fall from the ship would have killed her. She was blackmailing Paul English, and Hamish was suddenly sure she was blackmailing other people as well. And what of this Mrs. Merriweather, the rich American?
Had Granny Dinwiddie pushed her over and then taken her identity? The captain said they could sound alike, but that could have been part of the plot. If, say, Holly, the daughter, had murdered Paul, then he must have known something that had made them afraid. Hamish felt he could not rest. He got dressed and drove over to police headquarters to demand the files on Granny Dinwiddie's suicide. The reports were thorough and painstaking. There was even an attached photo of the dead body, and it could have been Granny Dinwiddie, although the fish and the immersion in seawater had made a right mess of the body. There was a long statement from Mrs. Merriweather about how they had become friends. Hamish leaned back, his hands clasped behind his head. So they had become close. That meant old Mrs. Dinwiddie would have been in and out of Mrs. Merriweather's cabin. Being a blackmailer, she probably automatically searched for incriminating letters. Or maybe she had thieved some jewellery and Mrs. Merriweather had caught her in the act. But there was certainly something fishy about the whole business. Mrs. Merriweather's third husband had died the year before, leaving her even richer than she had been made by the deaths of the previous two. Say she had staged the drowning to oblige Mrs. Dinwiddie. Could such an old lady survive the plunge from the deck, not to mention the long swim to shore? Some corpse would have to be found, but to a rich woman it would be easy enough to bribe someone at the morgue to find a homeless woman. He knew he was beginning to wander into the realms of fantasy, but the Dinwiddies, mother and daughter, had proved to be blackmailers. Of course, he could get into trouble if he made an expensive phone call to the Houston police, but he was itching to get something, anything, to go on. In the morning, he would get the daughter to explain where she was when Allison was attacked. He expected to have to go in for long explanations, but to his surprise, he was put through to a Captain Dexter, who said he had been suspicious of Mrs. Merriweather's late husband's deaths. But the widow was protected by wealth and connections on all sides. He listened carefully to Hamish's suspicions and then said, "I'll get there now. You want to know if she's got a Scotch companion? And if she has, she could have helped her fake her suicide. Right. On it." The evening drifted on. Hamish sat with his hands clasped behind his head and wondered where Blair was, and hoped Charlie was safe. At that moment, Priscilla was phoning her mother from London. "How's Pa?" she asked. "He's on South Uist, darling, doing something with sheep." "I hope you're not lonely." "It's rather peaceful, you know. Poor George was always fretting. Now he doesn't." "Is Hamish's cat still alive?" "Last heard it was. I took a look at the vets the other day. Doesn't look like Sonsy to me."
"Nor me. I've a bad feeling about it."
"Oh, don't you start to go Highland on me. Your father will be believing in fairies soon. He's even taking lessons in Gaelic." The phone on Hamish's desk rang shrilly, making him jump. It was the captain from Houston.
"Well, what do you know?" he cried down the line.
"Tell me," urged Hamish.
"I call up with some talk about housebreakers, and Mrs. Merriweather's there, all right. I see a movement through in the kitchen, so I say, 'I'll get a glass of water, ma'am.' She tried to stop me, but she's overweight, and in the kitchen, here's this old woman and a younger one. I starts asking them if they're friends. Mrs. Merriweather's shouting to leave the staff alone. The one starts to talk with what she thinks is an American accent, and ain't it Mrs. Dinwiddie? I dug up an old photo I got wired over on the supposed drowned woman, and the old one is her to the life. I have a woman cop with me, and we handcuff the pair and charge them while Merriweather is screaming that they forced her to do it. Took 'em all in."
Hamish begged him to email a full report. Then after he had rung off, he realized the daughter couldn't have been murdering Allison if she was in Houston. He sighed and began to write out a full report. Jimmy came and sat beside him and goggled at the screen.
"Good work, laddie," he exclaimed. "How did you work all that out?"
"Because I never believed Donald Biddy would take her own life. Who's guarding Allison at the hospital?"
"Blessed if I know. Blair took over."
"I'd better get over there. What was in that last report?"
"In a coma, but enough oxygen was cut off to damage her brain. They think if she does come out of the coma, she'll be a vegetable."
"Think she was blackmailing the murderer?"
"She's silly enough. Maybe she didn't know it was the murderer,
but someone she had seen that evening. Oh, well, I'm getting back to Loch Doo. I'm tired. Jimmy watched him go. Then he erased Hamish's name from the report and put his own in instead. He quickly switched off the computer as he saw Blair lumbering in and made his escape. Blair thought he could smell guilt. He switched on the computer, and the report, now with Jimmy's name on it, flashed up on the screen. Blair read it carefully. He dialed Houston Police and got through to the captain, who confirmed that a smart cop, one Hamish Macbeth, had done a great bit of work. Blair had been alarmed when it had looked as if Jimmy was in line to replace him, and so Blair phoned Daviot at home, and, putting on a ponderous, more in sorrow than in anger voice, told his superior about Jimmy Anderson trying to gain undeserved credit. Having put the boot in for Jimmy tugged at Blair's reward syndrome. He deserved a drink. He rummaged through the desks until he found a quarter bottle of whiskey and took one great slug of it, feeling his old friend coursing through his veins and demanding more. Out to the nearest pub, and three doubles later, his mind was full of Annie. Soon would be the wedding, and that must be stopped. Charlie must be made to have an accident. That shooting idea had been crazy, all the fault of those weird drugs. He'd stick to whiskey from now on. He was wafted off on dreams of Annie. They would get married, and he would lead a decent life, a life worthy of her. He never stopped for a moment to wonder what he was supposed to do about his wife, Mary. He decided to go to Uis the following day and see what damage he could do. Hamish had a sudden feeling that he should go to Brakey and check on Alison, but it was 3 in the morning, and his muscles were aching from the running, and he was exhausted. A silent figure crept along the deserted nighttime corridors of Brakey Hospital. No guard on Alison's room. The door quietly opened, and a shadowy figure slipped in and reached for the tubes connected to Alison's body. But approaching footsteps sounded, and the figure hid behind a screen and then decided to escape. Try again the next day. Jimmy was already on the carpet for having tried to thieve Hamish's detective work. He was protesting that Blair had done it himself in order to discredit Hamish. Daviot tugged his grey hair and felt he should be a tougher man and appoint Hamish up the ranks. Creeps such as Blair kept weak men like himself in power, as he realized in his odd moment of self-introspection. Hamish Macbeth was a truly unambitious man, and such men were almost impossible to understand. What was the point of having flashes of brilliance and not using them to further one's career? And why had Blair chosen this day of all days to go missing? Blair was on the ferry from Oban to South Uist, feeling like some medieval knight. Annie should be saved from a cloth-headed lump like Charlie Carter. He planned to lure Charlie out of the caravan after dark, forgetting it was still high summer and the nights never got dark. Inside his little caravan, George got ready for bed. He considered himself a very lucky man and was well aware that most newly engaged women would not have tolerated his presence. But Annie was as friendly and laid back as her husband. That his wife did not seem to mind his absence did not give him a moment's thought. He was well aware the marriage was arranged because of his money, and after the miracle of Priscilla's birth, they had lived together more as brother and sister. Blair had the plot clear in his head. He would set fire to the couple's van, shoot Charlie when he emerged, and he would say... It was as if a great tide of madness suddenly rolled from his brain, leaving him sober and very afraid. He clearly saw the investigation that would follow. His car had been seen on the ferry. He had bought petrol at the local garage. "Hamish's cat is dead," said the vet to his assistant. "Right glad I am, too. You would think there was something nasty emanating from it. I swear that isn't his sonsy. But Hamish won't listen to me." Suddenly the cat twitched and opened a slit of yellow in one eye. "Oh, the damn thing's come back to the land of the living. I should pull out the tubes and save Hamish some money, but I haven't killed an animal yet, and I don't mean to start." Hamish went to Brakey Hospital the following day, phoned headquarters for a guard on Alison, and was told to guard her himself, as they were short of men. He settled in a chair outside and wondered if they planned to send relief. A sympathetic nurse brought him coffee and a newspaper. It was sunny outside, and the air in the corridor was soporific. His eyelids began to droop. Soon, he was fast asleep. He was awoken 5 minutes later by a voice demanding, "How is the patient?" A policeman was standing in front of him, questioning an Asian doctor. "So far, so good," said the doctor. "I mean, she's still alive, but whether her brain will ever function again properly is another question." He walked off, and Hamish and the policeman surveyed each other. "I'm your new assistant," said the policeman. "Larry Coombe?" Hamish reflected that Larry looked about 14 years old, with his rosy cheeks and mop of curly brown hair. "Are you moving into the police station?" asked Hamish. "Because I'll need to finish clearing out the spare bedroom for you." "I'll live in that B&B along by the bridge, where Alison lived, until you're ready for me." "Grand," said Hamish. "Off you go. Come back and do a late shift for me, say 6:30, and then I'll take over again." Hamish felt the day drag on and wished he had asked Larry to come back earlier. The library trolley came round, and so he selected War and Peace, that book that sooner or later most of the reading population vows they will finish. He was just considering why the Russians didn't make it easier by sticking to one name when Larry came back, carrying a container of coffee and a Danish. "I'm all set," Larry remarked. "I'll phone if there's anything." His voice was Lowland Scots. "Where are you from?" asked Hamish.
"Montrose." "Pretty down there."
"Aye, but I got lassie trouble. She says I was going to marry her, and I said nothing of the kind, so I opted to get as far away as possible."
"Don't mess with the locals," said Hamish. "It's a small world up here. I'll be back at 6 in the morning.
When Hamish had gone, Larry ate his Danish and started to read the copy of War and Peace that Hamish had left behind. By 2 in the morning, he was fast asleep. Something woke him. An hour later, he sensed a movement to his right. But before he could leap to his feet, a bedpan was brought down, crashing onto his skull, crushing it, and he slumped to the ground. 2 minutes later, the lifeless body of Alison lay in a welter of pulled-out tubes, and a figure slipped quietly away into the night. Hamish was roused before dawn by a hysterical call from the hospital and alerted headquarters before driving to Brakey. The news was as bad as could be. Not only was Alison dead, but it was touch-and-go with Larry Coombe, and doubtful if he would be any more than a vegetable if he survived. A forensic team were busy, and he retreated with Jimmy to the canteen.
"Nobody saw anything," said Jimmy gloomily. "CCTV. Forget it. Does they work? Ugh, what's going on here? The whole thing is weird. I phoned Blair, and he says, in this scary, polite voice, 'I will be over later, Anderson, but I trust you to handle it in your usual competent manner.'
I'm right glad to hear he's in Strathbane, and not over in Uist, trying to kill Charlie," said Hamish. "There seems to be madness all around. This killer is an amateur who just takes chances, and is getting away with it. We've been thinking that English was killed because of his rudeness, but it could be something in his past. I'll need all the reports from Stirling. Maybe there's someone he made bankrupt, something like that."
"You should be down questioning the staff," said Jimmy.
"You've got a whole team doing that," Hamish pointed out. "Let me go back to the station and read all the notes about when he was a bank manager. It's just a hunch."
"Oh, all right. But if Blair comes chapping at the door, pretend you're out."
It was a grey, misty day, as if in mourning for the young policeman who, it appeared, might not survive. As Hamish approached Loch Doo, he was aware of an odd feeling of menace in the air and gave a superstitious shiver. He entered the police station cautiously, but there was only Lugs to bark a welcome. Hamish made a pot of strong coffee, fed Lugs some sausages, and settled down at the computer in his office. After an hour of searching, he found one possibility. A local Stirling shopkeeper had been made bankrupt and had hanged himself. He had left a suicide note in which he blamed Paul English. Hamish reached for the phone to call Stirling police, but then hesitated. He longed to interview the family himself. He read more of the notes, and his eyes brightened. Why had that not been noticed before? His wife and son had moved to Krask, up the coast, only a short drive away. He put Lugs in the front seat of the Land Rover and phoned Jimmy.
Did no one follow up the Krask lead? He asked. Who was on it?
McNab, but he was about to go when Blair was accused, and then I think it got forgotten. Let me know if you get anything.
Hamish drove on. He parked in the little main street of Krask. The mist had got thicker and seemed to blot out all sound. He went into the general store and asked directions to Lawn Road and was told it was two streets to the right as you left the shop. The house was on a council estate. Often people who lived on estates such as these bought their homes and the whole place took on a prosperous look, but this one had an air of decay and hopelessness about it. The gardens did not boast flowers or plants, but pieces of rusting machinery or old cars. He squinted at his piece of paper. Mrs. Trimble. He hoped she was at home. At first it seemed as if she had gone out. He knocked again, loudly, and shouted, "Police!" A light went on upstairs, then the curtains were drawn back, the window opened, and a frowsty, bloated-looking woman stared down.
"Give me a moment," she shouted.
It was more like 20 minutes before the front door opened, and she ushered him into a front room. Hamish waited patiently while she darted about, picking up magazines and empty cider bottles and stacking them in a corner.
"Sit down," she ordered in a rasping voice.
She had a sagging figure in harem pants and a T-shirt. Her blonde hair showed black at the roots, and her face was crisscrossed with red, broken veins.
"So what's our Bertha been up to?"
"Bertha?"
"My daughter. She's in Glasgow. Got done for drugs last week."
"It's not about her," said Hamish. "It is about Paul English."
"Paul? Oh, yon sod. Made us broke. We had a wee toy shop. It was all right, but we let folk run up a bill at Christmas and pay in the next few months. We asked the bank manager as usual to wait, and he ups and makes us bankrupt. My man took to the bottle and then topped hisself. I went down to that bank and told English I'd kill him. He called the police on me, bastard. You find out who killed him, and I'll shake that man by the hand, so I will."
"Have you ever visited Loch Doo?" asked Hamish.
"Aye. I went down to yon peat bog where he was found dead. I wanted to check out. He really was dead."
"But were you in, say, Knothen before he died, or did you meet him?"
"Hadn't a clue where he'd gone until I heard about the murder. We were a good family, and he wrecked us. Bertha on the streets, and me rotting away in this dump."
"Can you think of anyone else from the Stirling days that might actually have murdered him?"
"I could think better, sonny, with a wee drop of cider in me."
"Wait." Hamish went back to the shop and bought a bottle of cider, feeling guilty, but trying to persuade himself it was for the better good.
"Ta."
She seized the bottle, unscrewed the top and took a massive slug, slowly wiped her mouth with the back of one fat, swollen red hand and said,
"I call to mind he had this fiancée. It was the lassie's name, la-di-da, school teacher. He dumped her. She took an overdose, but got pumped out. Left Stirling. Caro, something or other."
Hamish drove back to Loch Doo and to his notes. He phoned the school and found out that a Miss Caro Fleming had left several years ago, and last heard was resident in Helmsdale, but they did not have her address. As he took the long drive to the east coast and Loch Doo fell behind him, the mist began to thin and disappear, and he had an odd feeling of having escaped from some sort of evil. Lugs began to wag his plume of a tail, and Hamish realized for the first time that his dog had been very subdued the last few months, and maybe had been missing Sonsy more than he had thought. He was wearing civilian clothes because he did not want to offend any local copper by appearing to poach on his beat. But no one seemed to have heard of a Caro Fleming. The sun had come out, and the day was sticky and warm. Hamish stopped in a cafe and ordered a pot of tea. As a faint hope, he asked the woman serving him if she knew of a Caro Fleming. She looked surprised and said, "That's me." Hamish produced his warrant card and asked her if he could have a chat about Paul English. Two women came in, and Caro said, "Not now. I close up at 6 o'clock. Come back then." Hamish was relieved that Caro showed no signs of having taken to drink or drugs. She was a tall, flat-chested woman with a long face, like that in a Modigliani painting, and she had long, thin hands and feet. He looked at his watch. Only half an hour to wait, and the tea was very good.
With Lugs at his feet, Hamish felt at ease for the first time in months.
"I hope this won't be too painful for you," he began, "but I am investigating the murder of Paul English, and I would like to know a bit more about his character." "He was a rude, cruel, and unfeeling bastard. All that man ever loved was money. It's only amazing that he hadn't robbed his own bank. I tell you, he wore an anorak with an inside pocket, and in that pocket he kept a wad of banknotes. Said he liked to feel them next to his heart. And to think I nearly married him."
"What stopped you?"
"Wait till I close up. It's a quiet day anyway."
She put the closed sign on the door and came back and sat down.
"More tea?"
"Yes, please."
"So, it was the week afore the wedding. I was paying. 'Lash out, sissy, wear white. I want the world to know I've bagged the prize.' Now, Maggie Friend, or what runs the chippy along the road, she's aye been jealous of me. 'It's your money he wants,' says she. 'Betcha he's got you to make out a will in his favour already.' Well, you know something? He had. But he was so loving, I couldn't believe it. It was when I found out I was going to wear a second-hand dress, and said I should wear only the best, and I could afford it. I said I had always been canny with money, and I'd seen this program about starving children, and so I had changed my will to leave all my money to the charity." A tear ran down her long nose and plopped onto the tablecloth. "That's when he told me straight that his only interest in me was money. He dragged me over to the mirror and jeered at my reflection. Then he walked out, and that was the last I saw of him. I'm glad he's dead."
Hamish patiently asked her where she had been on the night Paul was murdered, and she said she had been at a choir rehearsal in the church.
"I had a lucky escape," she said sadly, "even though it was so humiliating. He was the dirty beast."
Hamish drove slowly back to Loch Doo. He realized he had always imagined the murderer would turn out to be a man. But what if it was a woman? What of the minister that the little girl claimed to have seen with Paul in the vestry? He was sure if he tried to talk to her again, all that it would gain for the lassie was another beating. He turned off, took the road to Knothen, and stopped outside the manse. The minister, Maisie Walters, answered the door.
"Oh, it's you," she said. "Jake and I were about to have supper. Can you come back tomorrow?"
"It is just the one question," said Hamish. "May I come in?"
"Jake," he wondered, "who is Jake?"
"For a moment."
She stood aside. Hamish removed his cap and walked into the front room, where a table was set at the bay window. A small grey-haired man rose at his entrance.
"This is one of our elders, Jake Ingalls," said Maisie. "What do you want to know?"
"I don't think you have ever been asked. Where were you the night Paul English was murdered?"
"Good heavens," cried Jake. "Never say you suspect our minister."
"Mrs. Walters? I was working in my study on a sermon. Before that, I'd taken evening service. My car was parked outside here where anyone could see it. The light was on in the study, and anyone passing would have seen me at the desk by the window. Now, if that is all, our supper is getting cold. Do not come back without a good reason.
One more thing. Where were you last night? Did you go to Brakey?"
"I was here, in my bed."
Hamish walked to the doorway and then turned around.
"Did Paul English ever ask you to make out a will in his favour?"
"Why would he do that?"
"Seemed to make a habit of it," said Hamish, studying her face.
"Nonsense.
Now, if you've quite finished—"
Hamish left. He was sure she had been lying. As he drove down into Loch Doo, he could feel menace in the very air. He stopped on the waterfront where Archie MacLean was sitting on the wall, smoking a cigarette. Hamish had a sudden sharp longing for a cigarette, but fought against it. He lifted Lugs out and then joined Archie on the seawall.
"Grand evening," said Hamish.
"Aye, good few tourists this year. But something's bad."
"Like what?"
"Folk are sniping and bitching."
"Why?"
"Dinna ask me. It's something in the air."
"Unsolved murders poison the very atmosphere," said Hamish.
"How's yon cat?"
"Hanging in there. I need to make a decision soon."
"What do you know of the minister at Knothen?"
"Mrs. Walters?"
"Not much. You should be asking our minister."
"Should have thought of that. I'll go now."
Mrs. Wellington, the minister's wife, answered the door and glared up at Hamish.
"If you come mooching for a free coffee, you are not getting one."
"'I've come to see the minister,' said Hamish. "'For heaven's sake, woman, now I've seen everything. "'You're wearing a tweed pinafore.' "'It is just an old bit of cloth,' said Mrs. Wellington, "'who is famous for always being clad in tweed, winter or summer. "'You'll find Mr. Wellington in the study.' "'Mr. Wellington looked up from writing a sermon as Hamish entered.
"'Thinking about getting married again?' he asked.
"'Just my little joke. I can see it's not that.' Hamish removed his cap and ran a hand through his fiery hair.
"'What do you know about the minister, Mrs. Walters?'
"'Not very much. I was surprised because I took services at Knothen as well as here, but she seemed determined to get the church. I believe she preaches very impassioned sermons.
She does not like sex.'
"'In what way?' "'I gather she thinks it should be confined to the marriage bed.' She is constantly writing letters to the newspapers and television complaining about nudity and explicit sex.
Odd, coming from a woman who's been married.
Well, do you know, but it is a sad thing. There are still women who are so horrified by their introduction to intercourse that they say never again.
The minister looked sad. Bet that's what happened to you, thought Hamish. Then he thought of Priscilla's coldness and wondered again if something had happened to her long before he knew her to make her so passionless.
Would you say such as Maisie Walters could murder someone?
Frankly, no. She is too self-satisfied and always right. I think he was murdered by someone in a rage.
Unfortunately, he put so many people in a rage I don't know where to start. And while the murderer is out there, there's this nasty feeling all round the village.
"'It's the violet nights,' said Mr. Wellington, half to himself. "'It never gets really dark in summer, just this odd gloaming. "'People think that's when the fairies come out. "'I'll try to think of something for the community to do, "'some charity work to bring us all together.'
"'Let me know when you do,' said Hamish.
"'Charlie and Annie were married in Lochdoo Church on a fine summer's day. "'Annie wore a white wedding dress of silk chiffon, and had a coronet of pearls lent to her by Mrs. Halbert and Smythe on her head. They came from miles around, the celebrations went all night, and into the next day. Priscilla tried to suggest to her father that he might leave the couple alone for a few weeks, but he said they didn't mind, and so eventually went off in the wedding limousine, sitting in the back with the poodle on his knee. Hamish wondered who headquarters would send to replace Charlie. The spare bedroom at the station was now full of junk, and he would have to clear it out. He realized, with a pang, that he was going to miss Charlie's good-natured company. The news about Larry Coombs' possible recovery was more hopeful. A week after the wedding, he was strolling along the waterfront when his eye was caught by a poster wrapped round a lamppost. It said, "Help raise funds to save the cat." "Mr. Wellington's idea," said Angela Brodie as she walked up to him. "We all know it's costing a lot. There's to be a ceilidh in the church hall this Saturday. Mr. Patel is cooking up haggis burgers. Mrs. Halbert and Smythe has contributed 3 cases of prosciutto because she says it's cheap rubbish and they shouldn't be serving it at the castle. It's £10 a ticket. There's even 2 coachloads from Inverness coming up for the shindig. If it gets out that Sonsy is a wildcat, I'll be in trouble," said Hamish.
"Don't worry. No one's going to blab."
"Oh, dear," said Hamish, "now I feel guilty. If it was for starving kids in Africa, there wouldn't be this interest. It's always animals that people are prepared to pay to rescue.
Cheer up. It's being done for the village more than you.
There's been a bad atmosphere in Lochdoo."
Mrs. Wellington had thawed and given the money-raising venture her blessing when she realized she and her line dancers could put on their Stetsons and fringed skirts and perform "To All My Exes Live in Texas." The Curry sisters were to be allowed to sing one verse of "Come into the Garden, Maud," and the local schoolchildren were to perform the Scottish dance, the Petronella. Then the buffet would be declared open, and after that, dancing for all. To Hamish's delight, Charlie and Annie phoned to say they would be there, and Dick and Anka from the bakery were also coming and contributing trays of cakes. The party was well underway when the door of the church opened, and Detective Chief Inspector Blair walked in. Behind him came Jimmy Anderson, who went quickly to Hamish's side.
"Dinna fash yoursel, laddie," he whispered. "He's like a lamb these days."
And sure enough, Blair didn't drink anything stronger than Coke, and after 15 minutes took his leave. He had not looked at Annie once. "Isn't your pal George coming?" Hamish asked Charlie.
"There's a wee bit of trouble there," said Charlie. "There's this widow, Fran Mackay, nearest and newest, and she's set her cap at George."
"Does she know he's married?"
"Course she does. Annie told her straight, but she's got these great boobs, and they seem to fascinate George. He's beginning to think his wife wouldn't mind a divorce."
"Can't he have an affair?"
"George is hardly the affair type of fellow."
"Is he still a snob?"
"Not when it comes to me."
"Aye, but he always liked the lords and ladies."
"I suppose he always will. Hated being associated with trade. What about if the Earl of Strawban issued an invitation? That would get him out on the road for a bit."
"Could you wangle that?"
"I've still got that silver cup I won at his clay pigeon shoot. The winner is supposed to keep it, but he wants it back. I'll tell him he can have it, if he invites George."
It was as if the fundraising to save Sonsy had lifted the bad feeling from the village. Hamish was delighted to hear that it looked as if Larry would make a complete recovery, although it would take some time. Chapter 7 The Best Laid Schemes o' Mice and Men Gang After Glee. Robert Burns. The nights were beginning to draw in, and the mountains blazed purple with heather. Hamish heard that Priscilla was at Tomal Castle and made his way there. He found her helping in the gift shop.
"Up for long?" he asked.
She looked as perfect as ever, with the smooth bell of her blonde hair and her slim figure in a cashmere blue jersey and skirt.
"Just the weekend. Mother's a bit upset."
"What's up?"
"Well, she thought Pa was over in Uist haunting Charlie, and drove over, but Charlie said he'd gone back to the mainland, and Mother said that Charlie and Annie looked decidedly shifty. She's looking through the stuff on his desk to see if he left a clue as to where he was going."
"You look stricken. Know anything about this?"
"Me?
No.
I'll just be having a word with Mr. Johnson."
Hamish found the manager in his office.
"Do you know where the boss has gone?" he asked.
"No, but he was stinking of Tiger Balm aftershave. You know, that stuff teenage boys put on because they think it attracts the lassies."
Hamish had a sinking feeling. He was suddenly sure that George had taken the widow and her boobs to the Earl's home.
"When did he leave?"
"Yesterday." He was just leaving the hotel when Mrs. Halberton Smythe hailed him. She held out a letter.
"Do you know anything about this? It's an invitation to Strawburn's place, but George never said a word."
"He maybe thought you were still away."
"Don't be silly. He's the one that's always away, playing a sort of Robinson Crusoe over in Uist. I'll phone Emily and ask her what the hell is going on."
Hamish headed for the door.
"Wait a moment, Hamish," she called. "I may need your help."
She rang, and Hamish heard her side of the conversation.
"George is there with his secretary? Indeed. This must be a new venture. Yes, I'll be there around early evening."
"Oh, she does she? Well, I'll bring Macbeth as well." When she rang off, Mrs. Alberton Smythe fixed Hamish with a gimlet stare.
"George is parading some female as his secretary, and she says she is your cousin."
"Not guilty," said Hamish.
"Really? Well, you're coming with me to sort this out. Who is she?"
"She's a widow called Fran Mackay, who has set her cap at your husband.
He's probably flattered.
I'll get rid of her for you." It was worse than Hamish could have thought. Instead of being spurned as a common interloper, Fran Mackay appeared to have charmed the Strawbans. She had a great head of straw-coloured hair, rosy cheeks, and two magnificent white breasts, partly exposed by a low necklined blouse. Her voice had the musical lilt of the Isles. She had just been showing Lady Strawban an intricate knitting stitch, and Lady Strawban, who was an avid knitter, was hanging on her every word. The Earl was gazing at those bosoms with a silly smile on his face. Only George looked stricken and miserable at the sight of his wife. Hamish and Mrs. Halberton Smythe stayed for tea, and then she surprised Hamish by saying casually that she would see her husband some time or another. As they walked out to her car, Mrs. Halberton Smythe said,
"George really doesn't have much fun. He won't actually do anything. I mean, he's never been unfaithful to me. You young people, it's all romance with you. But for us, it was a business arrangement. People think that girls marrying for money belongs to the Dark Ages, but in my day you owed it to your parents.
What's really the trouble with Priscilla? Asked Hamish abruptly.
You will need to ask her.
I've tried. Then leave my daughter alone and find someone else. Everyone expects you to marry Elspeth Grant.
Why don't you?
She won't move back here, and I don't want to go to Glasgow.
How's your cat?
Still the same.
Some of the villagers are saying it isn't Sonsy.
Rubbish. I know my own cat.
The older people think it is lying there, emanating evil.
Hamish shrugged.
Half of them still believe in fairies.
The Colonel returned to the hotel that evening, looking sheepish. It turned out that Fran had been asked to stay on with the Straubens. George seemed surprised at this. Being English, he could never quite accustom himself to the democratic views of the Scottish aristocracy. On impulse, Hamish asked him to visit the police station and look at some murder case notes. George was thrilled. He longed to play Poirot. He sat in the office, carefully scrutinizing Hamish's notes, and at the end of several hours said, "Well, it is all very simple." Hamish looked amused. "Well, oh, great detective, tell me who done it, so we can get to bed."
"It's the forestry workers," said George. "They attacked him. They went back and chucked him in the bog when you weren't there. Simple."
"I'd like to think so," said Hamish cautiously. "But I am sure he phoned someone. It may have been someone he had been having an affair with that he didn't want anyone else to know about, and he had a throwaway phone."
"I think you're wrong," said George stubbornly. "I am sure Charlie would agree with me."
Hamish suddenly wished Charlie had not left to get married. He missed his easygoing company. George said he was going to Uist the following day because he had supplies to take to Charlie.
"I wish I could go with you," said Hamish, "but I've a mind to go round the hospital again. I wonder if the police looked at any CCTV cameras from the streets near the hospital."
When Hamish entered police headquarters, the first person he saw was Blair. To his amazement, Blair merely nodded to him and walked away. The detective had also slimmed down considerably, and his face was free of the marks of heavy drinking. In any other man, Hamish would believe some rehab had worked its magic, but in Blair's case, it was almost as if, without him knowing it, he was sobering up for something. All Hamish could hope was that the something wasn't an attack on Charlie. A policewoman dug out CCTV tapes that had been collected and placed them on a desk for him to view. "Solve the murder of Alison," thought Hamish, "and then I'll know who killed Paul English." The tapes were old and grainy and showed all the signs of having been reused over and over again. But at least when Alison was murdered, the summer nights were still light with that odd violet gloaming. Would the murderer have calmly walked in the front entrance? Very few people came and went, mostly staff standing outside smoking, despite a large notice which warned that no smoking was permitted on the hospital grounds. There were no cameras at the sides or back of the hospital. Hamish put in a tape for Glebe Street, the broad street that ran along the outside of the hospital. An ambulance raced up, a body was lifted out, the face covered by an oxygen mask. Hamish stifled a yawn as he continued to watch. Then he suddenly wound back the tape. A shadowy figure slid out of the hospital and disappeared up the side into the tree-covered shadows. Could be either a man or a woman, he thought. He froze the picture and leaned back in his chair, his hands clasped behind his head. "If I wanted to get right into the hospital," he said aloud, "I might fake a heart attack. When they had put me in some bed to wait for a doctor, I'd simply get up and find where Alison was, which they made easy on the final attempt with the policeman outside. So that's how it might have been done," he concluded. "Fake a heart attack and get an ambulance to take you in." He was unaware that Blair had been standing behind him. The detective went upstairs and into Daviot's office. He told him that he had been studying the CCTV footage, and he thought that the murderer might have faked a heart attack to get carried in. After the first attempt on Alison, everyone would have been alerted.
"Good work, Blair," said Daviot. "Keep at it."
Blair went back downstairs and told Hamish that Daviot had heard he was in headquarters and had ordered that he return to his beat.
"Sorry about that, old son," said Blair.
Leave the videos, and I'll get someone to put them away.
I think I should tell the boss that I need more time. I mean, Brakey is on my beat.
Something unlovely suddenly peered out of Blair's eyes.
Do as you're ordered, sonny, he said.
Hamish raced for Brakey with the siren blaring. He wanted to get there before Blair because Blair would be keen to follow up that lead. He found out the name of the ambulance driver who had brought in the heart attack. He was in their office having a break. To Hamish's questions, he said,
Aye, there was a wee man. We gave him oxygen and rushed him off.
Name and address? Asked Hamish eagerly.
Got it in the book. Here we are. John Clark, number 5, Orchard Road. Nurse says she went to move him to a bed, and he had disappeared.
Was he in the house or out in the garden when you called? Asked Hamish.
He was hanging out of the garden gate.
Hamish felt excited. This so-called John Clark possibly had found an empty house and pretended it was his own by waiting in the garden and then faking a heart attack. He said, Be careful. There's a man pretending to be a detective chief inspector called Blair. Don't tell him anything. Hamish raced to Orchard Road. The house was a villa with a large front garden full of thick bushes and trees. He went up to the front door and rang the bell. The door was answered by a small man with grey hair.
Mr. Clark?
The same. What's up?
Did you call an ambulance recently?
Aye. I was in the garden weeding, and I came over faint. But they left me lying in a hard bed, and I thought, Och, I'm okay. So I just walked home.
Dead end, thought Hamish gloomily. But he said, You'll have heard about the murder and the attack on that poor policeman. Did you see anyone suspicious?
No, not a soul. As I walked out, I could hear a lot of screaming.
Look, a man pretending to be a detective will call soon. Don't tell him anything.
Look, Mac, I won't even answer the door.
Shortly after Hamish had left, Blair arrived. He could see Clark inside, but the man made no attempt to answer the door. Guilty as hell, thought Blair. He called for backup, and when it arrived, told the man with the battering ram to break in. That was when Mr. Clark had a genuine heart attack, through sheer fright, and had to be taken off in an ambulance. The ambulance men asked the detective if his name was Blair, and getting the affirmative, threw Blair to the ground and handcuffed him with his own handcuffs. It took some time for members of the backup team to convince them that Blair was the genuine article. Blair was about to put in a report that all this misery had been caused by Hamish Macbeth. But if he did that, Hamish would reveal that it was his idea that Clark might be the murderer. He longed to go to the pub, but knew he would not leave until he was well and truly drunk, and he thirsted for revenge on Hamish. He was no longer obsessed with Annie, since he had thrown away those madness-inducing pills. But Hamish was another matter. He nursed all the humiliations he had experienced at Hamish's hands. All he needed to do was manufacture a simple accident. He wistfully remembered the days before the booze had taken over his life. He had been a good detective. He suddenly had a mad brainwave. He would go over every note on the murders and find out the name of the killer, and then he would do a deal. I will not arrest you if you kill Hamish Macbeth. Just don't murder anyone else. Foolproof. Mary Blair became uneasy about her husband. Not only was he sober, but he was bringing work home. She was used to expertly handling a drunk, but this sober Blair, who barked orders at her, she found scary. One morning she headed over to the police station in Loch Doo and found Hamish drinking coffee in the kitchen, reading the local paper.
"Pull up a chair and have some coffee," said Hamish.
"What brings you? Is he drunk again?"
"I wish he were," said Mary. "He's scary sober and works in the evenings going over all the notes about the murders."
Hamish's hazel eyes sharpened.
"Does he know? Ambition rears its ugly head at last. You know, he hasn't tried to get back to South Uist. Any sign he's still obsessed with Annie?"
"No," he said. "A lassie in love with a moron like Charlie isn't he worth bothering about?"
"Sour grapes." "Oh, no, he meant it. I said I was taking a run over to Loch Doo because Patel has some special deals, and he said I was to get into the police station. If he had any notes on the murders, I was to swipe them
and bring them back with me.
What's he about? He knows I never take the credit. He wishes I were dead. He...
Hamish's mouth fell open, and he stared blankly at Mary. She waved a hand in front of his face.
Planet Earth, to Hamish Macbeth. Come in, please.